This is the third session of the interview with Barry Trost. It is Trost, isn't it?
It's Trost. Not,
I heard somebody say Trost the other day.
No, it is Trost. Right. This is correct.
On February 6, 1986, and I've given you some questions here, which you said you had nothing to do with the Department of Defense, so we can eliminate that one. Is there anything you have that would be of interest to say about patents? Did you work through Wharf?
Well, I do believe that when one has discoveries that are possibly applicable in a rather direct way towards practical applications, that the university should be able to benefit from such discoveries. Now, our motivation in doing research is really the fundamental scientific questions and not whether we can or cannot obtain patents. So it is not a motivation for us to try to work in areas that we feel will lead to patentable inventions that would be commercially viable successes in some future time. However, as an offshoot of any kind of research, it is always possible that discoveries can be made that one can foresee the possibility that it would have some practical applications. And in that respect, I certainly think it is appropriate for university researchers to allow the university to be a beneficiary of those discoveries. We have had several occasions, and at the present time, we have just one of those situations, and we work with Wharf for two reasons. One, it's a very practical one, and that is that all of our funding does, or a majority of our funding comes through the federal agencies, and the federal agencies have a program that they will permit the obtention of patents on work that was supported by federal funds through what is known as the tripartite agreement. And as part of this tripartite agreement, the university has identified Wharf as the official patenting agency. And so it is our obligation to first approach Wharf and ask them if they are interested in pursuing a patent of that particular invention. If they are not interested in pursuing a patent, then we are free to seek patenting by other mechanisms. So the first pass is always through Wharf, and it's up to them to make an ultimate decision. The second reason is a very practical one, and that is, as I said, my interests really are not in the notion of patents, but really in the notion of doing the science. And I'm not willing to spend my time in order to engage in whatever activities would be required in patenting. And Wharf is an organization who is solely set up to do just that activity. And for that reason, I would prefer them to handle it because they know exactly what needs to be done and they're set up to follow through on all of the various aspects of that and take a minimum amount of my time being mainly trying to explain to them what is the nature of the discovery, helping and advising them in writing up the formal patent applications. But beyond that, it then falls in their bailiwick. So I feel very strongly that Wharf is an excellent group to work through and is the most appropriate way to realize the kinds of objectives that one would like to see from the patent discoveries, or the patentable discoveries that come from the university.
And how does it work out? You just phone the Wharf office and say, I have something you might be interested in, and they send somebody over?
Well, generally speaking, you call the people at Wharf, their licensing director and their staff there, and say that you have something that you think that there might be a reason for one to patent, and one goes over there and tries to describe the notion of the idea and why you think there is a patentable invention here. Not so much from the point of view that it's something that never has been done before, because that's more or less taken as a given, but from the point of view that there may be some reason to expect that there would be an interest in commercial exploitation of that invention. It's a little harder in my area because most of the work that we're doing is, in fact, in chemical processes. And in that respect, a process patent is one of the most difficult kinds of patents to try to write. The numbers of variables associated with developing chemical processes are quite extensive. As a result of that, it would be very difficult to imagine that you are really able to truly cover the process in all of its ramifications. And that if somebody really had a use for your process, that they might not be able to find a way to, in essence, practice the essence of the patent, but not the fine details of the patent. And in that way, circumvent the legal obligation to reimburse Wharf for its patent. So Wharf is much more cautious in undertaking process patents today than they were about 20 years ago. 20 years ago, they were much more lax in their patenting and proceeded with patents in a large number of areas rather readily, whereas today they examine each case much more carefully in trying to make ultimately a decision. It was a couple of years ago we had approached them with such a proposal, and they ultimately decided not to proceed with a patentable with a patent because they felt that there was not a mechanism by which they could police this patent if it were going to be utilized. At the present time, we're working with them, and in this case, they decided that they would proceed because there was a mechanism that they thought they would ultimately be able to use to police the patent if it was going to be utilized. So it's they are certainly trying to be more cautious in making determinations whether this is going to be successful or not as far as a commercial venture. But as I said, I don't think that should be a prime motivation for research at universities. In the field I am in, chemistry plays such an important role in industry. There is excellent research organizations in almost every major chemistry-related company, and this applies all the way from what are generally referred to as chemical companies to pharmaceutical companies to many other companies which one would not have thought to be chemistry-related, such as food industry, for example. And really, the trying to solve the practical problems of today mainly resides in the research laboratories of these companies. Nevertheless, it certainly is true that there is always those occasions where there is an offshoot of the work that one could see a more direct impact that one of these other research organizations would perhaps build upon.
Did you get a patent for that earlier? One that they rejected?
No, we decided not to pursue it. As I said, our prime motivation in obtaining patents is really the one that if we have a discovery as an offshoot that the university community could mainly benefit by that, and we don't have our own personal interests in mind there and are not willing to spend our own time in order to pursue that route, even though we might feel that this could have been a very valuable invention, that we just as soon just publish the work and let it be developed essentially in the public domain rather than trying to go ahead and engage in all of the various activities that would be required in order to patent it on our own.
I suppose faculty members vary in how they, I mean, I suppose some would pursue it, spend a lot of time pursuing it.
Well, I think that there certainly are going to be essentially all gradations of any situation in that kind of situation. And I do believe that there would be some people who would feel very strongly that they would want to pursue it and try to patent it on their own. It just happens not to be the way that it's not the way that I like to operate. As I said, it's really, I look upon it as an offshoot and not as a prime motivation.
But you you could comment, we're talking about the impact of federal grants on the University of Wisconsin and on your own work and how it might affect what you did and what you applied to.
Well, federal grants are an important support mechanism for higher education, in particular in the level of graduate education. There are various types of grants, what one should actually call grants and contracts, because the federal government operates on two modes. The grant mechanism is presumably a mechanism for supporting science, where you are more or less supporting the notion of innovative ideas and not for any particular end product. A contract is more or less an obligation to produce a particular service or product as a result of that activity. We don't engage in contract research, not because I think it is necessarily bad, but just because it's not the way that I think universities as a research resource for the country at large should operate. I do believe that the fundamental research that can provide for the long-term future of society is the major obligation of the universities. And one of the things that bothers me a little bit about what is happening today is the rush by universities to try to make profit from the inventions of their faculty, which I think is going to have more of a dramatic impact on what research directions faculty will take. That they will try to become more applied and more attuned to the problems of today rather than the problems of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Much more than what the impact that the federal government has, which has always been a worry that the federal government is what is leading research in universities. I don't believe that that is true. At least in my field, I don't believe it's true. When we think about problems in science, I think about the kinds of things that more or less excite me, what I perceive to be the major frontiers of the kind of synthetic chemistry that we're involved in. And I don't consider as a prime motivation whether I am going to be able to get funding for that or not. What I hope is that the work that we're doing is of a sufficiently high intellectual level and is sufficiently creative and innovative that it will be rated by my peers as being among the best work in the country or the world, and as a result of that, very strongly fundable.
Yeah, it has been, hasn't it? I mean, have you ever had trouble getting a grant?
Well, that's a hard question to answer on an absolute basis. I certainly worry, like all of my colleagues, as to whether I'm going to be able to maintain a level of support. And I have had grants that were not approved in the federal terminology, approved but not funded. We have been fairly successful in our ability of getting a level of support from the various federal agencies to sustain a size of an operation that we are very satisfied with.
Well, what happens to the grants that you don't get? What do you have to drop that work, or can it be carried on with department money or university money?
Well, there are various aspects associated with the granting mechanisms. What we try to do is to have the federal agencies support more or less a general program rather than a very specific sub-project. As I said, we try not to necessarily engage in contract-type research, but in more the fundamental science. And that gives one some latitude in terms of the kinds of problems that we are able to support under any given program. So generally speaking, the areas that we are most excited about would certainly fall within the general domain of one of the grants that we have. We have not had the problem that there was an area of research that we wanted very much to exploit but that we didn't have the funding for that area of research and therefore were precluded from exploiting it. Now, it is also true that there are additional mechanisms of support beyond the federal government that could help in allowing one to pursue areas which you felt might be totally afield from the things that one is doing. I haven't really perceived that this was necessary in any of the areas that we have been working in. So it's not something that, from my perspective, has been a problem that I had to deal with, although some of my colleagues always worry about this. It is also true that as you engage in a new area, something that you haven't been really involved in, how do you try to more or less get your credentials so that you might be able to be competitive in obtaining funding for that new area? Again, I think if an area is, if your ideas in an area are creative enough, exciting enough, and that if you've established your abilities of doing good quality science, that in general the review mechanism would be very supportive of people moving into these areas. And in my own case, as we moved into the area of transition metal chemistry, a field that we had no prior expertise, we didn't have problems with the funding agencies in being able to support work in that field, even though we had no prior experience in such a field. I think it's more in, say, the borderline cases where this issue as to whether a person really can work in a new field or not becomes a more prominent question.
You mean people who are borderline?
Right. In other words, people whose record is less well established, whose accomplishments have been perhaps good, but let's say somewhat on a more average plane, if they would perhaps want to pursue a totally different area, then there would be some interest in establishing whether they're competent to do that.
Well,
there is another aspect of funding which is also very important to the operation of any department, and that is the resources that a department has available. As you examine how one does research, it's not only the ideas that you have, it's also the kinds of questions that one can ask, which in part depends on the overall resources of a department. What one means there in part, of course, is the kinds of research instrumentation, both from the point of view of your training of students in doing creative research, but also in the ability of doing the research itself. This is mainly funded by the federal government and not by the local institutions. And certainly this department in Madison has been exceptionally successful in being able to have an extraordinary ability to obtain that type of equipment. The nature of the research enterprise becoming more and more dependent on equipment requires a constant watchful eye that one is able to stay at the cutting edge as to what are the developments in instrumentation. And this department has really done an exceptionally good job in doing that. And the majority of the funding for this does come through federal grants. So in that sense, helping to establish the resources that is important in both teaching and research comes from the federal largesse. There is, of course, an important university contribution to this because most of the federal funds are done on some type of matching basis. And the university here has been exceptionally good in its willingness to match the funds. But the impetus, let's say, the seed to get the university here to do that has to come from the federal government. And they provide, at least today, the majority of the funds for these purposes.
It's keeping up with what's new. Is this still, you spoke of Carl Bender before, is he still doing this, or do each of you keep an eye on things in your own field, and how do you decide if there has to be a choice among kinds of equipment?
Well, one of the things that is different about the Madison Department than other places is that it has been sort of centralized in a departmental instrumentation center. While it was not done, I think, too consciously in the beginning, Bender was the person who really recognized the importance of this and the one who put the mechanism in place. Now, Paul has retired some years ago, so that he is not personally involved any longer, but the mechanism is still in place, and the new director of that, well, he's been here for some years now, is Tom Farrar, and Tom has continued this trend. Now, there is an instrumentation committee which works with Tom, and it is the charge of this committee to sort through the kinds of needs of the department in deciding what is the highest priority for any given at any given time. And we have been very active over the last few years because of our concerns and needs, but we are not very active right at the moment in the sense...
Your lab?
No, we, the department.
Oh.
With respect to the Instrumentation Center, mainly because we are in fairly good shape at the moment. We are still looking as far as making sure we stay in such a situation, that we keep an ever watchful eye on seeing what are the needs of the various various groups in the department and making sure that we're addressing these. Now, there certainly are some areas that need yet to be addressed, but they are of a more specialized nature and would serve a relatively small number of the faculty. And in that situation, it's a little bit harder for one to move ahead as much. My area of research is not so specialized in terms of its equipment needs that we as an entity within the department have large, expensive items of equipment that only our group would be able to make use of. The kinds of large, expensive equipment that our group needs is very similar to that which at least a dozen other groups in this department would also have equal need for. And so our needs are usually satisfied by this departmental mechanisms. Some smaller items are things that we would obtain on our own through our own funding mechanisms, but that's relatively insignificant.
You mentioned just briefly last time that one of the big centers, what was the name of
it? I'm sorry?
One of the big centers where that are being developed, where there is very major equipment to which people go from universities when they need to do particular procedures. Physics has them. I mean, own lab was...
Right.
Was one.
Well, this doesn't really happen so much in chemistry as it does in sciences like physics, because you don't have these hundreds of millions of dollars type of large equipment needs. There's a small fraction of that's occurring in certain types of areas, especially in, say, experimental physical chemistry, where utilization of some of these larger facilities like a synchrotron radiation source, which is the Aladdin lab, the Aladdin facility outside of Madison. But that's again not, I would not say it's a major part of the kinds of things that chemists as a group need, and certainly not what synthetic chemists tend to need. So chemistry is generally considered to be sort of the cottage industry of science, whereas physics is generally thought to be what is called big science. And that mainly arises because of the idea that in physics you do have this critical need for these very, very, very expensive large facilities in order to do any kind of frontier research. Whereas chemistry has been much more modest in terms of its facilities types needs.
Shall we move on
to
the question about what it was that you were uncertain about recently? You mentioned it in the very first interview that you had. generally knew what you were going to do, but recently became quite clear you didn't.
Well, the biggest issue that I've had to face on a personal basis over the years has been the question of whether I would want to stay my entire career in Madison or move to alternative universities in the country. As I think that I've conveyed over the course of these interviews, Madison is an exceptional place and one that has been so exceptionally good for me that there's little motivation for me to want to, say, seek opportunities elsewhere. On the other hand, I have been approached on many, many, many occasions by many universities around the country as to whether I would be interested in making moves. Most of the occasions, it was rather a straightforward decision in my opinion, that there was little reason that I would seriously entertain an offer from that particular institution relative to staying in Madison. However, a few years ago, I had the possibilities of moving to Berkeley, and this was something that was quite different than any of the other things that I ever faced, in the sense that there was more reason that I might have want to much more seriously consider a Berkeley move than anywhere else. And it, in fact, had reached a point where I indeed accepted an offer to go to Berkeley, but after a lot of soul searching and with a great deal of reluctance, a lot of the reluctance did not come from the kinds of things I think it should have come from. In other words, a lot of the reluctance came from just the costs, the personal costs that would be involved in making a move of that kind, because there is a large difference in just the living costs for people in the Madison area versus the area around San Francisco. But it was a situation where the University of California at Berkeley is more or less probably the top department in chemistry in the United States. And it's a question of whether you would like to be in the very top department or in something that is not quite the top department. Madison is not quite the top department, although it has always been ranked in the top 10. This is something that becomes a little bit harder to discern for the future, whether Madison will be able to have that same degree of excellence as it did in the past. I think it's an issue that, in my judgment, is becoming more and more critical, not only for the present, but also for the future. The university in Madison is a little bit anachronistic in the sense that the degree of excellence that has been established at the university, it doesn't seem to jive with the state at large, that a state of this size with this kind of economic base, etc., would have a university this good. And in the recent past, it has certainly been a deteriorating situation in whether the university is going to retain that same level of excellence with the current atmosphere that exists in the state, and especially in the relationships between the state government and the university. At the current time, I think the future is not bright. I think the university is coming more and more under what I would say is unfavorable scrutiny by the state. And the state has been intruding more and more on making decisions for the university, from things that one might say are somewhat trivial, like establishing the academic calendar for the university, to things that are really quite significant in telling the university that it should establish certain programs of study, that it should be more, that the university, that the state government should be more involved in establishing the general academic programs and the way that the university uses its internal resources in establishing teaching loads and establishing other certain watchdog type activities. You probably want to say something.
No.
Okay. Whenever the state government starts doing these kinds of things, these are always done with certain political considerations in mind, and that becomes very, very detrimental to the university. It's in essence circumvents what was established when the university was established, and that is the Board of Regents, which was supposed to be the more or less administrative arm representing the best interests of the state for a long period of time. By the state legislature becoming more directly involved in the way the university operates on a daily basis, or at least on a yearly basis, it sort of undermines the notion of why the Board of Regents was established. And I think it's very much to the detriment of both the state and the university. And I would have to say that at the current point in time, I am sufficiently pessimistic that I don't know if I would make the same decision now as I did about 5 years ago.
And if the department sank below 10th, you would definitely not want to stay, I should imagine.
If I view the department as one that is on a decline rather than at least maintaining a steady state, if not on an ascent, then it's certainly not a type of situation that you feel comfortable in, and you would like to, you would like to try to do something about it. But in a state university, it's really hard to do things about it, because you really are talking about, in part, politics getting involved in the scene. So in my own case, it is clear that at a point where I feel that this is going to become detrimental to the long-term health of the department, that my ideas and attitudes will change, or I have changed. It's not unlikely for reasons like that, that in a few years' time that someone like myself might not be here anymore.
I'd like to ask you how much your family had a say in your decision, how much it was affected by what your wife thought. If she had been enthusiastic, would it have been easier for you to go?
Well, certainly you are not just a professional person, you also have a private life, and how your family views their lives plays a role in deciding what you're going to do. My wife happens to have grown up in Madison, although she was born in Chicago, and she feels very comfortable living here. She knows a lot of people here, and it would be reluctant to move, and at that time was very reluctant, and that certainly did not help in making a decision to move. And it was probably more influential in my staying than perhaps I would readily admit. But today, I think that my wife also, having gone through that period of time, looks at things somewhat differently, and feels also not quite that same degree of nervousness that she did earlier about the notion of going to a place where we have never been before. So I would have much more personal support in the notion of doing what I felt was really for the best interests, best long-term interests of my career. So as I look upon making a decision of that kind today, a lot of things have changed. Changed in a fashion that.
How long ago was this?
This was, essentially around 1980, 81. And, I guess what I'm saying right now isn't all hypothetical. There's something more substance to that. So there's a good probability I will not be in Madison a couple years from now.
No, I don't blame him. I must say, it must be depressing.
It is very depressing. It's very depressing for two reasons. One is because the state government doesn't quite understand how delicate a university really is. It is very, very easy to take what is more or less an esprit de corps of a university and absolutely ruin it. It's very easy to do that. It's very hard to build it. If you take a look at those places in the country that have been making attempts for literally decades to build a first-rate university, it's been very hard for them to do that. It's not an easy thing to do. Here's a state that has had one and seems bent on destroying it. And I just don't understand that. It's a total lack of trust on the part of the state legislature on what this university is about. One feels that they look upon the university as an activity that is somehow getting away with a large fraction of the state budget and for not necessarily valid reasons. And that's a very unfortunate state of affairs. And I feel uncomfortable in this kind of environment where they seem to express lack of trust in the university and in the faculty, and that means me. And I don't like the idea that they are suspicious about what I'm trying to do. That's not the kind of environment that I feel really, makes me excited about being here and wanting to be here and wanting to do more. It sort of turns me the other way of saying, why the hell am I doing this if all they're doing is questioning what the hell I'm doing? So I think that they are, as being watchdogs of the state purse, at times are being insensitive as to how you go about really doing that. And there has to be trust between people at some level. You can't try to account for every single thing that everybody does. That's the Big Brother society. And that kind of society is certainly a very sad state of affairs if we really come to it. We're coming pretty close in some respects. And certainly this university has gone from a situation of being really a fun place to be at, not as well structured as other universities, so that it had a certain degree of flexibility in really trying to look forward to really what is important for the long-term health of this place, to one where it seems to have to be constantly responding to the sniping of the state legislature and governor's office. I think that the change in the governor's office, starting with Patrick Lucy, has been very, very negative as far as the university is concerned. That the Lucy administration and the arrogance that they showed in establishing university policy, this question of merger, was handled badly and was really done without an understanding that a university is not a university, is not a university. You can't, because something has a title of university, doesn't mean it's the same thing. And University of Wisconsin-Madison is not the same thing as Eau Claire. And if you're not willing to come out and say that, that's being just plain stupid. And I think the state government has put themselves in exactly that position. And the way they went about mergers, some of the most ludicrous proposals fortunately never got into place. But it just really showed a total lack of understanding of what is a university. And a lack of openness to learn, because they really felt, they had the arrogance of feeling that they knew better than the university. And that was really a tragedy. And the state administrations, from the time of Lucy to the present, seem to just continue that same general attitude. And I'm not optimistic about about the university.
You know, Madison. Even O'Neill did not say that. He did not make the distinction between Madison and.
I think that somebody in O'Neill.
He was aware of it, but he didn't say it. He didn't come out and say it.
I don't think the president of the university system is in a position to say it, because I don't think they can say it.
The new president has said it. Whatever else he may be, he has said, acknowledged that Madison is different.
Yeah.
O'Neill didn't in his inaugural address. It's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting.
I've talked to him about it.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think the president of the system is in a delicate position because they are going to need to deal with all the various campuses. But it is true that this is a very disparate system. It is not a uniform system. I think that the highlight of that in recent times has been the internal turmoil associated with the so-called catch-up pay issue. There is no way that one can say that Madison should be treated in exactly the same fashion as all the other campuses. And surely, you know, if I was a faculty member in the other campuses, I would probably be screaming for my share, whether it's fair or not, as loudly as the other ones, and protecting my own self-interest. But in reality, they are competing on a different level, on a different plane. Fortunately, things weren't totally evened out in terms of the kinds of resources, but.
We don't need to have any discussion.
Yeah. Anyway, so to answer your question here is that, I expect eventually to accept an offer elsewhere. That will happen within the next 2 years.
Well, I'm glad you're saying all of this then.
You asked what would tempt me. I think that the kinds of things that tempt me in a university is that I want to be part of a university that it views itself as one that is in the top places in the country and wants to be there. Not one that establishes yet another committee that asks the question, can we afford our university? When they constantly ask that question and establish a committee to answer that question, it tells me that there is a problem.
Do you talk this over with your colleagues much? And is this generally felt? I know people are dissatisfied, but is it is specifically a problem for some of your friends?
Well, we certainly discussed this issue.
You just put a cloth barrier around yourself and say as long as one could.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine some people do.
Oh, yeah.
Out of self-defense.
Yeah. Well, I don't think people, well, we haven't as a group really discussed some of these things quite in the kinds of term. Well, I guess that's not true. We have discussed these kinds of things and are somewhat disheartened by this what we view to be a deteriorating relationship. So I guess we do commiserate on that one. Right at the moment, for example, we're trying to make a decision in whether we should promote somebody. And we look at his record and trying to say, you know, does this match our standards? Well, in making that kind of decision, one of the questions is, what are your standards? And so the notion of the kinds of things I'm talking about really impinge very much on what the future of the university is going to be. Because if your standards are going to be different now than they were 10 or 20 years ago, then you're going to have a different overall level of faculty. And it is affecting what people are deciding to do right now. And it may not be for the good, because once you start making decisions based on a lesser view of yourself, that's very hard to reverse. Because that decision is not a decision just for the next year. That's a decision for the lifetime of the individuals that you, if you are making a positive decision, for the lifetime of the individuals you are, in fact, promoting. So it's a very, very important kind of thing. And I think if people view themselves as being somewhat less than what they were before, that you're going to have this further erosion. And I think that's happening.
In your department?
I think it's happening in our department, yes. I think that one would see that people who might be promoted today, 20 years ago when I first came here, there would have been little question that you would not have promoted. And I think I've seen that happen. And I think it's going to happen more
in
the future.
Protest yourself?
Well, I guess I find myself in minority on more occasions than I would like to be on these kinds of points. So there has been more than one occasion in the years that I've been here that I have not been in favor of particular either senior level appointments or a promotion, where I have been outvoted by my colleagues.
Which is uncomfortable if it happens very often.
Well, I always like to operate on the basis that, you know, people are able to have honest disagreements. And I would like to have a certain image of myself and a certain image of the place that I'm at. And other people have other images. And that's why this kind of question as to how different these images become, that's where the critical question is. Now, in many of the cases that have happened in the past, I would have to say that my not being in favor of this was not a situation where I was so vigorously opposed to it, where I said that this was such a tremendous mistake. Okay. But if that gap gets too large, where what I perceive I would like to see as a department and what the rest of my colleagues would perceive they like to see as a department, if that gap gets too large, that's where it becomes intolerable. I would have to say that in the past that gap has not been all that large, but I can see it growing. And I think the impact of it growing is in part happening from what's going on with the state government. But there are other factors that are also involved. I mean, it certainly is a situation right now within the field of chemistry that you don't have that same broad pool of really top faculty candidates and top graduate students as can fill the major universities in the United States. The Midwest does not have a good reputation as a place that is highly desirable to go to. And so we have to compete much harder in order to convince people, say the kind of quality people one would like to have, to come here relative to going to someplace on the East Coast or someplace on the West Coast. We just went through a recruiting for a new faculty, and there were two people we made offers to. And the telephone call just a few moments ago was to tell me that one of those two people decided to go to UCLA rather than come to Madison. Which was very sad, very sad news indeed. The other person that we had made an offer to decided to go to Caltech rather than Madison. I like to think that the people we're trying to hire are the ones that are being looked for at the other major institutions in the country, that the MITs, the Columbias, the Berkeleys, the UCLAs, the Stanfords, the Caltechs, et cetera, are also looking for. And the ones that we've made offers to are the ones that have also been sought after by these other places. Unfortunately, we are losing in that competition rather than succeeding.
I don't want to pursue this too much, but were you not able to offer enough money, or was it other factors?
Well, I don't know. I think the nature of our offer, as far as I understand it, was in fact a very good offer. I don't know what the nature of the offer that they had from UCLA was, for example, in this one case. So it's hard for me to make a direct answer to your question because I don't have the full information
they
as
don't
to.
Tell
me. No. No. Normally they
I suppose
are.
You can find out sometime.
Oh, there's some point in time that if we really pressed them, I think that most would probably come out and tell us whether our, you know, how competitive our offer was per se. But the point is that being competitive is not enough, because we have to, we also have this image to overcome. And so it has to be more than competitive. And that's what makes the difference. It looks like we are being competitive, but we're not giving that extra kick that makes us a little bit more competitive, that would make it hard for them to say, well, these two offers are the same, but I'd rather live in Los Angeles, for example. Well, that's something that we happen to be in Madison, we're not in Los Angeles, that we have to sell our area. But certainly the attitude of the state towards the university also plays a role in these kinds of things.
I think I'll move on then to a question. You said you thought every active researcher ought to be willing to accept the chairmanship, and because the chairman ought to be in touch with research. Do you feel, given your attitude to the state policy, that perhaps you ought to go onto the university committee or do something at that level of the university to try and combat what's going on? Or would that be going too far, because then you really would have difficulty keeping up with your research?
Well, I think that a person has to make a decision in their own careers as to where their talents can best be utilized. I stand by the statement I made previously that I do believe that it is important that active people get involved in some aspects of the administration of the university. On the other hand, I certainly also feel that my tenure as chairman convinced me that I'm not an administrator. Okay, but I do feel that the fact that I don't want to be in any kind of direct administrative role doesn't mean I should not play a role in certain committees that would be involved in helping establish university policy and helping to explain the university to groups outside.
Have you been on such committees?
No. No.
Have you been asked to be?
No. I'm pretty outspoken, and I think people don't like individuals who are too outspoken about things.
Is it that, or is it that they're protecting you because of your research?
Probably a little bit of both. I think that there has been attempts by certainly people in the department in saying that Barry's resources probably can best be utilized to allow him really to focus on his research, and I think that certainly has occurred. On the other hand, I also believe that, as I said, I'm not shy in making my views known, and I tend to get fairly emotional about some of these things. And so I do tend to be somewhat outspoken. And so I also think that people don't necessarily want someone who's too outspoken on some of these other committees, that they could be less, pardon?
They
could be a nuisance on the committee, rather. They could be less helpful than otherwise. And I think that's part of it. Some years ago, I got so upset about some things that were happening where the university administration was starting to become more structured in some of the things that they were doing, that I actually initiated an activity to get a group together, to group of principal investigators on campus to discuss this issue of postdoctoral associates on campus with the university administration. And it was not well received by the university administration.
Who was the administration at that time?
Edwin Young. Oh. Edwin Young and Serena Pondrum. They basically felt that I was treading on their territory. It was in their prerogative to do what they saw fit in establishing policies in that area, even though these were areas that there never existed policies previously. And all of a sudden, they decided to create policies. Now, they never explained to us why they decided to create policies where they didn't exist before. And it was establishing some rigidity, which
this had to do with appointments
of post,
length of appointment.
Right. And it's just seemed to be establishing unnecessary restrictions in doing things most effectively. A postdoctoral student isn't an employee, that's number one. And somehow in a bureaucracy, it's not understood that a postdoctoral associate is not an employee. So they immediately try to establish an employee status for these individuals rather than as a student. They're a student at another level. They're not an employee. They're going to be here for a 1 or 2 year period. And they're not going to be here from a July 1st to a June 30th. They're going to be here from whenever they get here to whenever they leave. And it will be for a 1 year period, but it may be from January 1st till December 31st. But yet they were establishing guidelines which totally ignored the realities of what is the nature of the appointment and exactly how these appointments are established. One very simple illustration. You make an appointment for somebody and saying that you're going to be able to pay them at a certain salary for a year. University now says, as of July 1, they have to get a raise, regardless of whether that's halfway through their year or not. Now, that's just stupid. That gives you no ability of controlling your own budgets. You don't know how much money you're going to have because the university will arbitrarily tell you that as of July 1, you have to give that person a raise. Even though you agreed that the person's going to be here for a year and it's going to be at this rate of pay, university says that's irrelevant. Well, that's stupid. Because somebody may decide, you know, you might make the original plans that they're going to come July 1st, but they're a student and they may not have finished their thesis until October. It's very common that somebody doesn't come until 2, 3, sometimes a year after when they were first thought to be able to come. The university doesn't understand that. They had established this as an employee, so they were paying retirement benefits. The person's not going to be here a year. I mean, it was just ludicrous what was being done. And yet, they said it's in their prerogative. And it certainly is in their prerogative, but why would you want to do it?
Was it reversed?
No.
Subsequently?
Well, the thing we finally got them to take out was to exempt these people from this retirement business. I mean, even they could recognize that this was ludicrous. But the other aspects are all in place. And it just got me so mad that I got together a group of major principal investigators on campus to try to discuss this issue with them. And I would say that the response of the administration at the time, in particular response of Serena Pondrum and Ed Young, was how dare you question our authority? That they were really upset that I would dare do that. And I found that to be incredible. So I have a bad reputation with the administration because I'm not willing to just sit by and let them do some things that I think are stupid.
The administration, I mean, that was a rather unique administration.
Oh, it sure was. I mean, Serena Pondrum was really quite a person. When she left, boy, that was the best thing that I ever saw happen. But it's still part of this. And it's just somewhat ironic that we called this the principal investigators group. That a few years ago, they now established a committee of the university called the Principal Investigators Committee. But the forerunner of that was this ad hoc group that I got together.
So this would have been around 1970 or 71.
Well, it was whenever Serena and Ed Young were in
yeah.
power.
Yeah.
That's the period of time.
So do you have any papers from it?
Oh, in fact, I just threw them away. You know, I was just going through my desk and I had some papers of my correspondence with Serena Pondrum at the time. Because every time I looked at the papers, my blood pressure just rose again, so I just decided to throw them away.
you who are interested in history.
Well, I guess I don't, I tend not to think about those things. But that did happen at that time. And it was the only occasion that got me so mad that I felt I had to do something instead of just sitting by and just saying that the university can just go any way it damn well pleased. But that was, again, the whole mechanism here becoming much, 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 much more formal. And I think it's not to the betterment of the university to become, to have more of these. Now, part of it, I understand, is arising because of various things that are happening in Washington, where the university is being forced to be more accountable for certain things. I recognize that. But my position is that the university shouldn't go overboard. Okay, you have to be in compliance, but you don't establish more bureaucracy than you absolutely have to. It always seems that they are more than happy to go much more than they necessarily need to. This was clearly a case where it wasn't a matter of being in compliance. It's a matter that someone decided that they wanted to do this. And the only thing I can assume is that someone was Serena Pondrum, who I view to have been someone who was a very power-hungry person who really wanted to have a large fraction of the operation of this university under her thumb.
University, and sometimes it seems to be true and sometimes not. This is tape 6, I guess.
One of the strengths of the Madison campus, I do believe, is the ability to have in one place essentially every major discipline represented, and in many instances with a very, very high quality faculty. My own research has certainly benefited by contacts with a number of people in, for example, zoology, pharmacy, entomology, biochemistry. One of the major programs that we undertook in the very beginning days of being at Madison was in the area of insect hormone chemistry with people in zoology. Subsequently, we had a program which was involved with some of the people in the entomology department on, again, insect pheromone type research. We have close relationships with the people in the School of Pharmacy, that a number of them have interests that very, very nicely dovetail with the kinds of things that go on in the chemistry department, and as a result of that, that there is a very, very beneficial and mutual interaction. In particular, people like Professor C, who is just an extraordinarily individual in microbiology and its implications in the chemical sciences. A resource that is almost unique in the world. People like Dick Hutchinson and Dan Rich, who also are very, very well-known scholars in the areas of biotransformations and peptide chemistry. And also the school and the Department of Biochemistry. There has been good interactions, although not quite as extensive as it has been with the other places, in my own case. And I do consider these strengths very much so of the Madison campus. As I look at myself, I can certainly see that my career in several very important ways, especially that early collaboration with the zoology group, was very much impacted by having these types of individuals close by.
There's no reason to think this wouldn't have happened anywhere else.
Well, it's somewhat harder to say. Certainly, there are other places that will have excellent groups in allied areas, and probably the kinds of disciplines that one's talking about here are probably represented on any single campus today. But in some places, and I'll take, for example, the University of California system, because I think Berkeley is a good type of state institution that I believe Madison should try to compare itself with. That the Berkeley campus is not a comprehensive campus in the same way that the Madison campus is. So that biochemistry, for example, as a discipline, did not grow as strongly, as readily on the Berkeley campus because the School of Agriculture, if you want, didn't exist there. It existed at one of the other campuses. Whereas here, School of Agriculture and the College of Letters and Science are really both together, and I think that that is good. I think that's been a strength of the Madison scene and of the University of Wisconsin, that it did retain a full comprehensive university and didn't dissect it up into various components. Many of the state states established what they considered their professional liberal arts campuses, the University of Michigan being that, and then their agricultural campuses, Michigan State being its agricultural campus. Now, Wisconsin didn't do that,
yes,
and I think it was
greatest strength, I guess.
I think it was correct it didn't do that. Absolutely. And that did make Wisconsin different than a lot of the other state institutions around the country. So I do believe this is something that has been good, and I don't see any reason why that aspect of it should change, because I don't think that they would split the campus here to say that they'll have to move the letters and science expertise to one of the other campuses, or the ag school to one of the other campuses. So that certainly is a long-term strength of the Madison campus. But I would have to say that probably as I look at some of the places around, you have the ability of having those interactions, but it's surprising to some people as to what goes on in some of these, what you consider, or what I would tend to consider somewhat more esoteric type departments, that there's really some fascinating fundamental research that very much impinges on chemistry. And that makes Madison a rather interesting place to be at. As far as say other areas like say subgroups within the department, I probably have more interactions with people in the School of Pharmacy than I do with people in theoretical chemistry. So it's really it's hard to put your finger on what makes interactions important to your to you personally.
We'll try.
Well, it in part is the way people think about problems. That theoretical chemistry here really grew up more from the physics viewpoint, and it might be more properly described as theoretical chemical physics rather than theoretical chemistry. So the kinds of problems, scientific problems, that they tended to be interested in had little to do with the kinds of real molecules that I, as an organic chemist, worry about. So that it almost is a point where there's almost no dialogue that can occur. That
seems
they
to have been quite a bit of disapproval of the institute in the chemistry department. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's a fair assessment, that there was a schism between the Theoretical Chemistry Institute as an entity and many other members of the department.
Kind of maverick.
Well, I think in part it was a reflection of the director of the institute that...
I'm going to be interviewing Hirschfeld.
Right.
That
his approach is not very constructive for interactions. That it made it very difficult for one.
I mean, it could have been a place that might have been useful to you, or
it could have been more useful if they were more chemically oriented. As I mentioned, Hirschfelder ran this more or less as his child, and really dominated the organization, and I would say stifled the development of the other members of the institute. That the people who would tend to become really independent-minded on their own tended not to survive there. And I'm not talking about people not surviving because of their scientific accomplishments or capabilities, but survive because of the environment that they found themselves, that this was not the kind of environment that a good scientist would accept. That they are going to be subservient to someone else. That Joe's approach was that it was his institute. And in that respect, the members of the institute, to some extent, were beholding to him. And I, as an independent scientist, and people like me who are not going to accept that idea. And I think that caused difficulties within the institute, so that some of their very outstanding people essentially left. And I would say that this was part of the reasons. Although I don't think that they would necessarily point it that way, because everybody has a lot of respect for Joe as a scientist who has been an exceptionally creative and an exceptionally important figure in physical chemistry. But that doesn't translate necessarily to his administrative ability. And I think he didn't approach the administration of that in the best possible way. The kinds of things it worried about and the way it was organized really put it apart from the department. And so instead of becoming a resource for the department, it sort of stood aloof from the department, both intellectually and administratively.
And so with somebody else, this might have been something that would have been a welcome addition. Is that right? Or would it always have been on the peripheral?
I think that with the right person, that could have been a very welcome addition. Mm. But I don't think Joe was the right person. There is another aspect associated with it, which maybe also contributed to it, and that was there was what is called block grants. And in a block grant, an agency would give a sum of money to support a number of investigators rather than a single investigator. But somebody had to be identified as more or less the person a little bit above everyone else. Let's call him a director. And it really becomes a question of how that person views himself or herself. If they view themselves as being the one who's responsible for the block grant, and therefore all the others are secondary, that creates one type of situation. If they view themselves more or less as equal, except that person happens to bear the administrative burden of being the coordinator, that creates quite a different situation. The Theoretical Chemistry Institute was of the former category, not the latter. Combine that with the way that, or the type of people that were recruited who more or less reflected the problems that Hirschfelder felt were important, rather than saying that we're going to worry about theoretical chemistry as a intellectual discipline, not just theoretical chemistry defined by myself, Joe Hirschfelder, but as a broader-based scientific discipline, that also could have had a big impact. And Joe tended to be much more on a narrow point of view. So if there were theoretical chemists who would worry about molecules, I think things could have been different, but they didn't. And that created not a good situation. And things could have been a lot different. Yeah. So I don't think it was all bad as far as the Theoretical Chemistry Institute. I think that it did have a good reputation for a certain period of time. Not in its latter days, it didn't. People recognized that it got stale because the kinds of problems that Joe was interested in got stale. They can be only exciting up to for so long, and if you don't really move into new areas, you tend to become stale, and I think that's what happened. And I think things are much better today, but they are not as strong by any means as what the Theoretical Chemistry Institute was viewed to be in its heyday, even though I think it's better representative of chemistry today than it was before. But it doesn't have the same quality faculty in the area of theoretical chemistry. And I think that's a shame, that it could have been an incredibly good resource that just wasn't. So I, on the other hand, the people that I mentioned in these other areas, they talk about things that we can communicate with. They, although you have a microbiologist, he worries about molecules. Although you have a zoologist, he's also recognizing that molecules are at the base of the kinds of science that he's doing. And the same thing in entomology. So while they might not know that much about molecules, they're interested in them. And so they're willing to talk to you about them. That's what made it fun to interact with these people, because you had some common denominator that you both recognized. I would say that the Theoretical Chemistry Institute, they consider talking about a molecule as dirtying their hands. No, that's not very helpful. I remember one time at a faculty meeting where Joe described an organic chemist as an old man standing over some pots and pans boiling up his brew. That's not a very constructive thing to say. Whether he believes it or not, it's not something you say at a faculty meeting.
So Jack Williams said his work was described as slop chemistry.
It's funny how certain activities, while in some respects they're really not very important, but they tend to make an impact on you. Events happen that are really relatively minor events, but things that sort of stick, and they do color the way you think about other people. And you know, this little event that I mentioned with respect to Joe, it happened when I was an assistant professor here, and I still remember it. It obviously made a big impact on me, although it was just a statement, you know, a comment that he made at one of our faculty meetings. I just said, that's really rather strange for somebody to say that. And there's a man who can't draw the structure of benzene. As an organic chemist, benzene is a very simple molecule. It's really a very fundamental molecule. It's something that you can't imagine that any chemist of any stripe wouldn't know what that is. Many people who aren't chemists know what it looks like. Here is one of the premier theoretical chemists in the world who doesn't know what it is. To me, that's incredible. Well, that shows you the breadth of the science in one respect, that the science is that broad, really. But on the other hand, it also shows you something about the nature of the person that's involved and why it's so hard to communicate then what your problems are. That, I think, in part, was why there was always this schism that existed between the theoretical chemistry people. Because theoretical chemistry probably wasn't the right name. Theoretical chemical physics would have been a much more proper name. And it didn't work out. One of the things that I did as chairman was insist that this be integrated into the department. The opportunity arose in part because Joe retired. And to maintain a organizationally separate entity like it was, I felt, could not continue, that it was not in the best interest of the department to have it so separate that it operated as part of the department when it damn well pleased, but apart from the department when it also pleased it, that this was not an acceptable way of operating. And so it was integrated in the department. And any real opposition by the people in the Theoretical Institute that was the right thing to do. And Phil Certain, who at that time was acting head of the Institute, was very, very cooperative. And I think Phil also felt that something had to change, that there had to be a better interaction. I think Phil has been very constructive in dealing with the problems that existed. Right now, I think things are much better as far as the interactions are concerned, but the Theoretical Chemistry Institute really doesn't exist. There's a name that's still there, but...
I see. That's what I wondered. It's not really an important...
It's not very important. It's sad to say it, but it's... Yeah, it's sad to say, but it's just not very important. It's not recognized as being a major institution, theoretical chemistry in the world. So it's it's not what it was. And it's not likely to change until you get some extraordinary people in there, and that's not going to happen. Not for a long time. Not for a long time, if ever. And that gets back to the question of what's going to happen to the university, which we don't want to get into again. Okay, where should we go from here? When this TA strike, is that what we're up to then?
Yes, unfortunately.
TA business. The issue of labor unions in a university is a curious question. Labor unions had a real purpose in the way that they were established and in the kind of context they were established. But the question then arises, are they applicable to all aspects? And while I can recognize that in an environment like an automobile production, that a union has a very, very important role to play, I somehow cannot equate what a university is supposed to be and unionism. To talk that TAs are employees only is ludicrous. It's again not recognizing what a university is. Yes, it is true that TAs are performing a teaching function for the university. And as for performing that function, they are being paid a salary. That's true. But that is only a small aspect, and I emphasize small aspect, of what it means to be a teaching assistant. Because first of all, to be a teaching assistant, you are in fact a student. That can't be ignored, first and foremost, especially in an area like chemistry, because a student isn't somebody who is just there going into a teaching laboratory. It's somebody you're working with as a student on a daily basis. And nobody can say, from 9 to 12, I'm going to be your adversary, and from 1 to 5, I'm going to be your colleague. That doesn't happen.
Did you have students who were in the TAA?
We've had students who were in the TAA.
In your lab?
Yes, I had students in my lab who were in the TAA.
At the time of the TAA strike?
At the time of the TAA strike.
Did it create trouble? Did it create dissension?
Oh, it certainly created a lot of emotionalism that was totally unnecessary. Well, I wouldn't say they confronted me in the sense that they felt that what I was doing was an adversarial thing to what they believe should be done. In other words, I don't think there was a disagreement between themselves and myself in terms of what was the purpose of, or how we were going about doing our teaching and research. So there wasn't any issues in terms of what we were doing. I should point out that the chemistry department TAs did not vote to join the union. That didn't mean that there weren't members of the chemistry TAs.
Were very bitter about the chemistry department. I know that.
Well, no, not all. There were a few.
No, no. I mean,
there were a few
some.
Who were very, very bitter. Not so much from the point of view of the department per se, but the point of view that more or less I expressed, that the faculty of this department, I think, on large, were very, very much opposed to the notion of a union among TAs, as I would say that they are opposed to the notion of a union among faculty. So it wasn't that they said it's not for them, but it's good for us. It's just they said that unionism and a university just don't mix. That's not what a university is all about. And it shouldn't be for students, and it shouldn't be for faculty, because that's not what a university should be striving for. A university, whether you want to call it right, wrong, or indifferent, a university is a place where you should be striving for excellence. And that's not what unions are about. Unions are to protect the rights of the average. And it always, whether you want it to or not, it always averages. And when you average, you go down. You don't go up. It just doesn't happen.
Complete agreement with you.
Okay. And I just cannot understand the concept that you can say that a person is, for the part that they are a teaching assistant, they should be unionized. But for the part that they're a student, they should not be unionized. It's the same person. It's not two different people. And they don't look upon themselves any differently. And when they get involved in these kinds of things, they become fully involved, emotionally involved. And there's no way that they separate themselves. And surely, I mean, there were some very good students who were very much enthusiastic about the union, and, so, and many of them left. Okay, they, I mean, their graduate programs were destroyed because, not because we necessarily as a faculty deliberately destroyed them, because we didn't, but they became so emotionally involved with thinking of the rightness of the union and the wrongness of the university that they just had to part ways. And I think that that was very unfortunate. And I don't think that you establish this kind of adversarial relationship in a relationship between a student and a faculty person. And there's no way that you can describe any union. There's union, there's workers, and there's management in a union situation in the way that they are constructed in the United States. And you have workers on the one hand and management on the other hand, and they are, by definition of a union, adversaries. That's the way unions operate in the United States. And that's exactly what they were creating between student and faculty. And that's just wrong. And the TA strike was just incredible. And that's one thing I will never forgive Edwin Young for. I don't care what were the basis of it. For him to voluntarily recognize a union, I think, was a tremendous mistake. We could have gone through whatever was necessary in terms of the kinds of demonstrations and emotionalisms at the time, that would have been a hell of a lot better than to be saddled with that union. And I don't understand how, again, state government, in all of its wisdom, saying that we should have the right to choose. As Earl's point of view, we should have the right to choose. How can anybody argue with giving you the right to choose? In many other areas, they don't agree that you should have the right to choose. The government should tell you what you should do. Government there, they said, has the right to exercise leadership. That also can apply to the question, the philosophical question, do unions belong in a university, either for faculty or for students? And I think that when this university becomes unionized, and indeed it will, that that will be yet one more step, and a big one, to mediocrity. And that's another thing that scares me. Because they're going to pass faculty unionization. And sure, how can you argue with, I think they are. I think they're dead set on doing that. I saw unions operate in universities in the Scandinavian countries. And I know how they operate there. And they do operate in universities. And it's just incredible to think what goes on there. To show you how, you could say it's extreme there, and that can never happen here. I'm not so sure. Because there, you don't only have teaching assistants unionized. Students are unionized. And students now, students are unionized, and they negotiate with their teachers for the course content. And they negotiate what's going to be used as a text, how many pages of that text are going to be required. And I had the rather curious occasion when I was there as a visiting professor in Copenhagen, where they had an American who came over there and would join the faculty. And he gave some handouts, some additional material. And the union issued a protest. They issued a protest because it was not covered by the labor contract. The contract did not include handouts. So here he was doing something extra. But, you know, as to fulfill their membership, Their point is, less education is what their goal is as a union.
Don't breathe a word about that around
here. Well, but there it's operating, okay, yeah, at a university, and it's gone to that extreme. Now, you can say it'll never happen here. Well, I'm not so sure it can never happen there. You would say it could never happen anywhere, I would have said. But it's there it is, okay? So, you know, how far you can push this, I don't know. But I just don't think universities and unionism go. And I think the TA strike was a good illustration where we became in part a little bit of a symbol with the TAA, is because first our students on the whole were not sympathetic. So most of our students, in fact, totally ignored it. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, the faculty here was so outspokenly against the TAA as the notion of unionism, so that they were going to break this department by preventing any kind of deliveries, et cetera.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of things going on around this building, not from our students inside the building, but from the TAA as an organization. And of course there were, as I mentioned, there were certainly some of our students, I think I could count them on both my hands, who were very enthusiastic about it. But it was a very sad, sad time. And I hope we don't see a return to that. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see when they have, I assume they're going to have some election at some point in time, with the state legislature allowing this to be reestablished. And I am curious to see what the students today think about the appropriateness of unions. I hope that they are more sensible than their earlier counterparts. I assume the reason that the union has not yet issued an election call is because they don't feel they yet have the support to win it. So we'll see.
Well, we're nearly at the end of the tape, and I want to thank you very much for doing this, giving your time.